You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. With the National Guard being reactivated and now the news of the death of another Idaho child from COVID-19, there are many questions to be answered today from our medical experts. So let's get right into it. Joining us are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, as well as Dr. Patrice Burgess, Executive Medical Director at St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center in Boise and chair of the Governor's Vaccine Advisory Task Force. I want to thank both of you for coming on the program today.
Thanks, Gemma.
Yeah, thank you, Gemma.
And remember, if you do have questions for our experts, get them in now, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. So first, let's talk about the governor reactivating the Idaho National Guard. He did this on Monday to help primary health and the corrections department. He secured 500 personnel through a state contract to help Idaho hospitals. So, Dr. Pate, can we talk about this and how will this help primary health as potentially also hospitals? Because we know we see the impact first at urgent cares and then there's a domino effect.
Well, that's right, Gemma. And this isn't the first time the governor has deployed the National Guard to help healthcare providers and particularly primary health. Primary health is a particularly important resource for us because, number one, just as you said, they're kind of on the front line. So we get our first indicator from them. But second, because they operate an extensive chain of urgent care facilities throughout the Treasure Valley, it's hugely important to ambulatory access. And what we had seen is that primary health, because they had so many of their own employees out in isolation or quarantine, they were having to close a number of their sites and close all of them about an hour earlier. So that's going to restrict access. St. Alphonsus has also been similarly challenged and has had to on occasion, closed some of their sites temporarily. So it had gotten to be a significant problem. And we're very grateful to the National Guard. There's many things that they can help to do to take the pressure off of the reduced workforce at healthcare providers that have a lot of employees out. So they've been very important in making sure that people can still get access to care, testing, evaluation, what have you.
And with that being said, then, here we are in the middle of this surge, Dr. Pate. Is this going to hopefully give a reprieve and help us get over this surge and peak?
Well, I think that, you know, we've seen hopeful signs here in Idaho. We were rather late to the party in our Omicron surge, and therefore a lot of the other parts of the country are improving before we did, but we now have enough days of improvement that I think we all feel confident saying we have hit the peak of this surge and we're on our way down. The question is if and when the next surge will be. There are many saying we won't have these kind of surges anymore after this. I don't believe that. And I am particularly concerned because of some reports indicating that the quote-unquote natural immunity from Omicron may not be as good as the other variants, and that in fact, this second version of Omicron, which is here in the United States, but not causing a problem yet, but has been causing a problem in some of the European countries, is causing another surge for them right after their first Omicron surge and with a lot of reinfections. So I think we're going to have to monitor closely, but I do think we're on the way down, which is great. I think we will get a reprieve. The question is how long?
And Dr. Burgess, can we talk about some vaccine news? Pfizer asked, I believe just yesterday, for the FDA to authorize the COVID vaccine for children between 6 months and 5 years old, under five. So, A, what does this mean? And when could we potentially see this now available for this vulnerable group of kiddos?
Well, as you remember, it does take a while to work through the process. So, you know, they have to meet and review all the data, and then it goes to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. So I'm assuming we're several weeks away. The other thing I just kind of want to reassure people when they think about this population is these studies have been going on for quite some time. Remember, before the vaccine was available to adults, it had been studied for, you know, at least 6 months prior. And then these other vaccines in the younger populations kind of staggered and started after that. So I feel confident the FDA will be very cautious, but I also feel confident these studies have been going on for quite some time. And kind of to dovetail on the discussion around healthcare workers being infected and or quarantined, this is also a big issue is our children, both for their own safety, but also when we have children bringing infection home, then that takes down that entire household that has to quarantine. And that's a lot of what we're seeing with our healthcare workers, in addition to their own infections, is infections with their families.
Right. And Dr. Burgess, can you also talk a little bit about COVID antiviral treatments? I believe that there are two that are FDA approved, but health experts here in Idaho from the Department of Health and Welfare are saying basically we should not necessarily depend on these two antivirals because they're in short supply.
Absolutely. There are two, but the supplies are being allocated kind of like we experienced early on in the vaccine rollout where we had limited supply, but this is even more limited. And think of it kind of like Tamiflu, if any people are familiar with Tamiflu that we use for the flu. It really shortens the course of the illness and the severity. It's not necessarily a cure, but it does, you know, minimize the symptoms and the length of illness. But if anybody was around for H1N1, we ran out of Tamiflu as well. So it's a Band-Aid. It's not a prevention, and it's certainly not something I would rely on. Because of the limited supply and because it would be better not to get the infection at all rather than to get it and then have to try to minimize the symptoms. And because of the limited supply, we're really reserving it right now for people that are at the highest risk of severe disease. So immunocompromised patients and those folks that we know are at the highest risk.
And Dr. Pate, on Friday, it was announced by the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare that Ada County had found the new subvariant of Omicron. So what does that mean? Because in places like Denmark and in England, where this new subvariant has come, it's extending their surge.
Well, that's right. And that is what I was referring to when I was talking about us hitting our peak with this form of Omicron, which is called BA1. There is this other, what we call a sublineage of Omicron, which is called BA2. Now, ordinarily, we wouldn't be overly concerned because typically when people are infected with one of the same variation, a variant of concern, they tend to have a pretty good short-term natural immunity against other forms. The problem why this is a concern is that appears to be much less the case for this one, meaning that people that have been recently infected here in Idaho with the current form of Omicron, which is BA1, we fear that if BA2, which is what has just been identified, if that takes off, then they may be thinking that, oh, well, I just had COVID, so I don't need to take precautions. And yet the early evidence we're getting from Europe suggests they may be at very increased risk of getting reinfected. And we don't know what the consequences of reinfection and multiple reinfections is on the body. We are certainly seeing some early things that cause us concern that it's not good for your body to be repeatedly infected with this. We should note that repeat infections does not mean that you'll have a milder case. In fact, our very first case in the United States of the Omicron we've just been going through was somebody that was reinfected in his 50s and he died.
And Dr. Pate, can you talk a little bit about this? I know this is preliminary research that's coming out in regards to this new Omicron variant. And this is how it's impacting children in that 0 to 2 year old range. And we should note, I mean, this is preliminary, but I think worth discussing.
Yeah, there is a concern, and certainly we've noticed it with this first Omicron wave, that we saw many more children admitted to the hospital than we did previously. So the question is, well, why is that? And one answer could be, well, if you just infect a whole bunch more people, then if it's the same percentage of kids, obviously more kids will end up hospitalized. So it may just be a factor of the fact that we've had way more people infected with Omicron this time than we have previous surges. On the other hand, there is some concern that there is something different going on with kids. A factor why kids may be struggling with Omicron a little bit more is that, contrary to our previous strains, Omicron has been much more of kind of an upper respiratory illness, affecting the upper airways more so than the lungs. And children have very small nasal passages, and they tend to tolerate congestion and so forth less well than older people. And in fact, we saw a number of cases actually presenting like croup. And so it may be that young kids are going to struggle more with this form of the variant. But it is concerning. We've gotten some unconfirmed reports. We're trying to get to the bottom of it, that Denmark may have in fact seen a pretty significant increase in the hospitalizations of 0 to 2with this BA2 variant. But I have not been able to track that down to any of their official sites for confirmation. I just haven't seen them publish any data. So we're trying to figure out if that's true or not. But I think we have to take this seriously. And even though people are out there saying, oh, Omicron is mild, we need to understand that it's mild for those that are vaccinated, and particularly fully vaccinated with the booster. It does not necessarily mean it's going to be mild in everyone. And in fact, we've had many deaths and many hospitalizations. This is good news about we're getting an inch closer to having a vaccine for the young children. And I think parents need to really reconsider their stance if they're hesitating about that, and consider protecting the children, particularly those in that 0 to 2 age group, which actually is the group that had the best response to this new Pfizer vaccine. Mm.
And Dr. Burgess, before we take a break, can we talk a little bit more about this idea? Because I do believe we're seeing this a lot. It's in the media, it's in mainstream media, it's on social media platforms, is that Omicron, as Dr. Pate said, is more mild. Can we clarify that? I mean, you are on the vaccine task force for the state of Idaho, and the fact that, the vaccines are what's helping Omicron be more mild. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, I think that's a correct statement, but I think there's also, it's just behaving differently than what we saw with Delta. So with Delta, our ICUs did fill up more quickly than they have with Omicron, but the infectivity rate of Omicron is dramatically more than the infectivity rate of Delta, even though Delta was pretty infective. So one of the things that we track among a variety of statistics is our cases per 100,000 people. We kind of look at that as a gauge for how rapidly the pandemic is spreading, how much protection we need to be using as healthcare workers, et cetera. And back in July, we had almost gotten below 50 cases per 100,000. And we were even starting to think, well, maybe we could relax a little bit on some of our protective equipment. And then Delta came along. And I firmly believe had we had a higher vaccination rate, we may not have seen Delta, or we certainly wouldn't have seen it as significant as it was, and probably not Omicron either, but that's water under the bridge now. So in any case, we almost got below 50 per 100,000. Then we jumped up into the 200 to 400 per 100,000. We're now up over 1,000 cases per 100,000. In some areas, wow. 1,800 cases per 100,000. And so the infectivity is so much greater that exactly as Dr. Pate said, if you infect that many more people, then you're going to have a certain percentage, maybe the same percentage that get ill, but it's just going to be more people. And we know that those are the immunocompromised, you know, the vulnerable folks, the small children, as we just discussed. So that's a lot of what we're seeing. The other thing that's different with Omicron is it seems to be fast and furious and then taper off a little more quickly. So that people may be calling that mild, but people are pretty sick at those first few days. But as you know, the CDC changed the quarantine requirement because it is appearing that it kind of, for most people, runs its course more quickly than Delta did. But what we still don't know is the long-term effects, as Dr. Pate mentioned. We know with Delta and prior, the original SARS-CoV-2, that there are people that get long COVID symptoms or syndrome. And we don't yet know, just because Delta may be lasting a little bit, Omicron a little bit less days of illness, we still don't know, does that mean people might have long-term effects? So again, I wouldn't recommend, you know, going out there and getting Omicron to try to create immunity. As we discussed, the immunity is unreliable as well, but it's really Russian roulette. You don't know if you're gonna be one of those people that gets real sick. You don't know if you're gonna be one of those people that has long-term effects.
Before we get to all of our listener questions, I do want to briefly touch on the fact that it has now been confirmed that a second Idaho child has died from COVID-19. And Dr. Pate and Dr. Burgess, I'd like your thoughts on this, because we saw an infant pass late last year. Now we know this is in East Idaho, a child between the ages of 13 and 17. I am still stunned, Dr. Pate, that we have now had two children die from this, and yet our vaccine rates are still so low.
Yeah, it's amazing. The power of disinformation. Two, the human ability to rationalize or minimize things. You know, Dr. Burgess and I have spent our careers focused on patient by patient. And, you know, when we're taking care of that patient, we give them our all. And for us, it's when we're taking care of that patient, it's either 100% survival or 100% mortality. And so we tend to view the world that way. I think a lot of Americans, unfortunately, in my mind, tend to look at it, well, that's two kids. You know, how many kids do we have in Idaho? That's, you know, that's lower than your risk of then fill in the blank. And I get that. The problem is we can't always predict which child is going to be. And it would be one thing if it's a risk that you can't mitigate, but we have the ability to mitigate this risk. And that's what is, I think, very upsetting to those that are in healthcare, is even if we could save one child's life or two children's lives, wouldn't we do that? Wouldn't it be worthwhile? I mean, we're not asking people to go donate one of their kidneys. We're asking them to, would you please consider getting vaccinated? If you won't get vaccinated, would you please wear a mask when you're out around other people? And if you're not feeling well, stay home. And yet that seems to be too much of a sacrifice. It is just absolutely tragic when we have a child lose their lives, and the emotional toll on healthcare providers, plus the fact that we have to console those parents. And that's two children that have died, but I don't think that will be the end of the story. We have other children who are critically ill that I'm praying for that they will recover, but we don't know yet. And this is far from over.
Dr. Burgess, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I certainly echo what Dr. Pate just said. And it is disturbing the ability of folks to either rationalize or ignore what's really going on. And I would just offer, I mean, when in our lifetimes have we seen the National Guard called up more than once to help our healthcare systems that are struggling? We at St. Alphonsus, and I'm confident this is probably similar at other facilities, we have been in what we call incident command mode for almost two years now, as has our umbrella organization, Trinity Health. Incident command is normally something that you open up when you have like an airplane crash or a massive, you know, trauma of some kind, and you stand up your incident command, like when we had the shooting at the mall, and you make sure you take care of that disaster. It's not something you typically do for 2 years. So that in itself is exhausting, because every single day we have a meeting to look at our resources, make sure we know where the open beds are, we adjust our surgeries if we have to, on and on and on. And to have people not think that that's a big deal is really, again, mind-boggling. And our staffing issues, again, when we come to rationalization, people say, oh, it's because, you know, you're not paying people enough, or your vaccine mandate, or any number of things. That's not it at all. Our volumes in the hospitals are higher than normal. Our ICU volumes are higher than normal. And, you know, we are having to rely on both resources from traveling agencies as well as FEMA resources. And now the National Guard again, helping out healthcare facilities. And if that's not enough to help people realize that this is a serious situation, I really don't know how else to impact, you know, people. But it is serious. And getting vaccinated and all the things that Dr. Pate said, if you're sick, stay home, and wearing a mask when you're out and about in a crowded area, are all the right things to do to help us get over this.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Pate, Jane and Eagle has a question about masks. She purchased some masks from a company called Lutena in sizes for adults. Lutena's kids masks are mentioned on the CDC's list of counterfeit masks. Now, the only information printed on the mask said made in the USA. So Jane wants to know if those masks are safe. And Dr. Pate, I do believe you did some research into Jane's question, because we've had these questions before about these counterfeit masks, and how do we know?
Yeah, exactly. And because I've gotten so many questions about it, I did do some research on this. So the first thing is that, you know, if you're looking at masks for an FDA approval stamp on it or mark on it, you're not going to find that. The FDA does not regulate masks. So don't worry if it doesn't say FDA approved or FDA certified or authorized or anything, because the FDA doesn't do that even on the good masks. The organization that does certify those and gives their stamp of approval for American masks is NIOSH, N-I-O-S-H. And so if it's an N95 mask, you do want to look for that NIOSH certification. It should likely be stamped on the mask, or it's certainly on the packaging material and so forth. The problem is NIOSH will not, it does not evaluate children's masks. And so there are no NIOSH certified or approved children's masks. So what I do for the children's masks, and when I've picked out masks for our families, children, and so forth, There's actually a guy that he goes by the nickname Mask Nerd, and I believe it. His name is Aaron Collins. And so I look to him for a lot of advice on this because we just don't have other good sources. And he is a mechanical engineer and an aerosol expert that actually tests these masks. So I looked up the company that your listener wrote about, and I don't know if this is the same mask that she's talking about, but he did test the Lutema M95C mask and he for children. And he found that, first of all, that's a KN95 mask, and he found that it was 98.6% effective. So if that's the mask your listener's using, that's going to be a good one. For other people, you can certainly look. He has a whole spreadsheet of all the masks that he's tested, but there are certainly other good masks. And there's one for those that are particularly worried about fake masks. I found this interesting. There's a company called Powecom, P-O-W-E-C-O-M, and they make KN95 masks for 7 to 12-year-olds. And he tested them. They were 97.3% efficient, but they also come with an anti-fake label on them to verify authenticity. So Do your research. There is information out there. You can find a good mask, but just, again, don't be worried if a child's mask does not have the NIOSH certification.
And Dr. Burgess Helen just wrote us in to say that the number of patients with COVID at St. Luke's jumped dramatically yesterday compared to the day before. She said on Monday, 146 patients were in isolation. Yesterday, that number was 268. The number of COVID patients in the ICU also shot up, 17 on Monday, jumping to 33 yesterday. So she has a question for you. Is this an indicator that Omicron cases are still on the rise here in Idaho? And are you seeing a similar pattern at St. Alphonsus?
So, you know, again, Omicron is incredibly contagious. So we are seeing that continue right now. We do lag behind, as Dr. Pate mentioned, the East Coast. So if you look at what happened on the East Coast, they had a rapid rise and then a rapid drop. We are seeing the last few days a slight decrease in our test positivity rate, which is another statistic that we look at, and another thing that primary health is very instrumental in because they do a lot of testing, but we do our own testing as well. And that rate is starting to drop down. Again, those numbers are still pretty dramatic. Below 5% is what you'd like to see to say that the pandemic is waning. And we got around 6 to 7% at one point. Right now, we're hovering in the 40% range, although we started to see some dropping again over the last few days. So those hospital cases are going to lag behind that. When you see the test positivity rate be high, the hospital cases are about 2 weeks after that. So I think we're still seeing cases that from over the last couple of weeks, and hopefully we'll start seeing some improvement over these next couple of weeks.
Dr. Burgess, we have a question about vaccines from Dale, and he writes in, with booster efficacy starting to wane, will everyone be allowed a fourth dose of the vaccine?
So we certainly don't have that information yet. We are now seeing the CDC approve a fourth dose for the immunocompromised and high-risk individuals, but not for the general population. There's also discussion of reformulating the vaccine for the new variants, but that would take some time, and I haven't heard, any soon-to-be released other vaccines. So I think for now, it's really the immunocompromised people that we will be looking at that fourth dose or new primer series, depending on how you word it.
On Monday, public health districts said that they had a backlog of more than 41,000 COVID tests that had not been reviewed. We got a voicemail about those unprocessed tests, so let's take a listen to this.
I am Ada, and I live in Boise. My question is, the daily count of cases of positivity rate, it's an alarm system to let us know what else public health officials and government officials need to do to adjust the measures as the pandemic spread. Right now, Idaho have close to 40,000 positive cases that are not accounted for. So my question is twofold. Number one is there any estimate of what is the true average daily count of positive cases? Number one. And number two, with a more accurate count, if the positivity rate right now is 34%, what then would be the real positivity rate? I am concerned that we are dealing with a wildfire and we are telling people, don't leave your house until we can confirm that there's fire right behind your house. That's my question. Thank you.
Dr. Pei, can you take that one?
Sure. So when there is very extensive disease transmission as there is now, higher than we have ever seen before, we do overwhelm our public health system, just as we're at times overwhelming our hospitals and our ambulatory care system, because there's just not enough people to review all of these tests to ensure that whether this is a new case or a repeat positive of somebody that's already been counted, those kinds of things. So that does take time. Here's what I would tell you. She asked about, there being a fire or a wildfire. Mm-hmm. There's a fire, okay? And yeah. We know that even without these cases counted. And so as she points out, and Dr. Burgess referenced, a testing positivity rate that approached 40%. Well, and as Dr. Burgess says, what we think it needs to be in order to show that we've got this under control is less than 5. So, we're not even close. So whether the true testing positivity is 40 or 45, that doesn't matter. We are out of control right now. And understand that those cases are always going to be underreported. Why is that? Because we've got a lot more home tests approved now, and a lot of people mm-hmm. test at home and don't get one of the tests that does get reported to the state. So the case counts have always been able to tell us it is at least this. But probably more. And that is certainly the case right now.
And Dr. Burgess, Andrea wants to know if we are allowing people back out into the community too early because of the new CDC recommendations. She says her brother tested positive for COVID. He's out of quarantine window of 5 days per the CDC recommendations. She wants to know how contagious he is, though, because he continues to test positive on the antigen test, but he doesn't have any fever or really very few symptoms now.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we do know that, Omicron kind of peaks higher and faster and then drops off faster. But remember, the 5-day rule also recommends 5 additional days of masking and avoiding close contact with others. So there's a full 10 days. It's just a modified quarantine because we know for a lot of people, their infectivity rate drops more quickly than it did with Delta. But he should still be very, very careful wearing his mask, trying to separate himself when he's eating so he's not around other people for that additional 5 days. It is a little concerning that his antigen tests are positive because that usually does indicate that there's some active virus still going on. So I would continue to remain cautious. And it is great that we have some of these tests to kind of help guide us because our symptoms sometimes are not as good guiding us. We know when you have a lot of symptoms, obviously you're very infective, but you can also be infective a couple of days before and a few days after those symptoms are not around.
Dr. Pate, we have a email in from Beth, and she would like to know about the efficacy of cloth masks. The reason why is that in schools, we know that so many schools are wanting to stop masking, saying that cloth masks don't work. Her next question is this: are masks causing mental health issues with children? She says we continue to get many emails from parents saying mandating masks is causing mental health issues for our kids.
You know, it's a great question. You know, there's no denying that some children have trouble tolerating masks. We don't have any evidence at this point to say that just because they're wearing masks at school that they're suffering psychological injury. It could be, we just don't have any evidence of that. I think one of the things that we observe is that children adopt a lot of the feelings and views of their parents or whoever their caretaker is. And so certainly if parents complain about it, if parents say, well, this is awful, this is just terrible that you have to do this, I mean, kids will pick that up. On the other hand, you know, in our family, we wear masks when we're out. We don't make a big deal about it. And we find that, you know, our grandkids don't mind. In fact, a lot of times that we tell the grandkids, hey, you can take your masks off. They say, oh, well, it's no big deal. I'll just leave it on. And so I think a lot of this, you know, the problem with trying to make a judgment is our masks causing mental health problems is there's a lot of things that could be causing mental health issues. It could be issues going on with their parents. It could be that they've had a serious illness in their own family and the child is scared. It could be that the child is old enough to know that they may have been the one to bring the virus home and infect somebody that they care about or love. They may have lost a parent. So there's all kinds of things that can be contributing to mental health issues. And unfortunately, we just don't tend to have balanced discussions, as well as the fact that we have recently seen alarming information about how many people have new mental health problems following COVID infections. And so we don't know how much of this might be that actually some of these kids actually got infected. So it's just a complicated question to answer. I think at this point, you know, the prudent thing is let's protect other people, let's protect families, let's protect children, and then look for those opportunities that are safe where children can be children and don't have to wear the mask.
And Dr. Pei, can you also touch on the other part of Beth's question, which was the efficacy of cloth masks? I think that this is something that many people are struggling with, or say masks never worked in the first place because the CDC has changed its recommendations.
Yeah. Well, the reason the CDC has changed their recommendation is because the virus has changed. And as we've been talking about on your show since 2020, Gemma, is that, unfortunately, people have taken the view of, well, look, it's mild and let's just go ahead and get infected. We'll get it over with. We'll have immunity. We'll get some people have suggested we'll get herd immunity. Of course, those things are all wrong. You do get some temporary immunity in many cases from being infected, but it's temporary. And you certainly don't achieve herd immunity. And so as we've allowed this virus to continue to transmit, it is replicating trillions of times and making errors. And the way that this virus has evolved is to continue to keep getting more and more contagious. To the fact that the virus we're dealing with now is like four times more contagious than what we dealt with in 2020. So what was perfectly good in 2020, cloth masks, is not as effective now. And this doesn't mean, oh, well, then we don't need a mask. No, what it means is you need a higher quality mask.
And Dr. Burgess, Shelley sent this in today. She says, my family has so far been able to avoid contracting COVID. We've done everything right. We've gotten vaccinated. I'm starting to be concerned, though, if we're putting ourselves at greater risk against the next variant by working so hard to avoid Omicron, especially if the next one isn't a mild variant. Is there a risk of that happening?
Oh, congratulations to them for being cautious and doing all the right things and being successful at avoiding getting infected. That's impressive considering our high rates of transmission right now. They're doing all the right things. I think they stay tuned if boosters become available that are recommended for them under whatever their circumstances are. And we know so far, all of the variants, people that are vaccinated have milder illness and less hospitalization and less death. So I would just, my hat's off to them, and they're doing all the right things. There's nothing else I would recommend other than continuing to do the right things and watching for booster opportunities if they become available.
And we just have a couple of minutes left. And I know, Dr. Burgess, you wanted to take a few minutes to talk towards the end of the program. So I want to give you the floor.
Well, yeah, two things, Gemma. Thank you. First of all, Dr. Pate's always so gracious to thank me. And I think we all owe him a huge debt to what he's done for our state and continues to do and all the research and time that he spent. So I wanted to make sure and get that out there. And then just wanted to take advantage of your listeners with the opportunity. Even though this isn't COVID related, we desperately need people to donate blood. So I just wanted to put that plug out there. You know, unprecedented times we're seeing with all the things that we're talking about with the pandemic, and now a blood shortage that we've just never seen before. So just wanted to encourage folks that are able to get out and donate blood to help the supply. Thank you.
And Dr. Burgess, where can people first donate? And then how do you know if you're eligible? Because my 10-year-old came up to me the other day and said, he goes, well, I'll donate my blood. And I looked at him and said, yeah, you're too little.
Yeah, the Red Cross website should have all of that information. And they, you know, they will also, they're very gracious at the site, have you run through a questionnaire. And you know, if you can't get the information you need on the website, but I would go there and you can type in your zip code and they'll let you know where there's availability to donate. And I just really wanted to get that message out because it's a pretty significant problem right now. Mm-hmm.
And we have talked about this a bit more. We have about a minute left. And Dr. Pate, I mean, this is critical. I mean, in the 2 years we've been doing this, this is the first time we've talked about a blood supply shortage.
Yeah. And so first of all, thank you, Dr. Burgess, for your very kind comments. I'm greatly touched. It is a big problem because, again, when we take the attitude that, well, it causes mild illness, so let's let it rip, what happens is exactly what we're seeing. Lots of healthcare providers or people that interact frequently with the public are out ill. And that is what has also happened to our blood banks. And so it's a real problem. And this and so it's just another point that if as I hear from everybody, we want to get back to normal. Well, the best way to get back to normal is let's stop this transmission. So for now, please get vaccinated. If you've been vaccinated, please get boosted if it's time for you to be boosted. And whatever you're doing, when you're out and about, you're going to be around other people, please wear a high quality mask. And schools, you need to help us. You are a big part of helping us get to the point where we can get back towards normal. Please help protect students and please decrease the spread.
And also I want to thank you, Dr. Pate, and you, Dr. Burgess, because you are also helping us to get to the other side of this with the facts, with the science behind this, and what we need to do to get us to the other side. So I want to thank both of you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gemma.
Yeah, thank you.
And I want to thank all of you for joining us. Remember, our medical experts will be back next week. Get your questions in. idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.